Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday. It is the 19th of July. It is 14 minutes past 9 o'clock. I hope you had a lovely, rainy, dark weekend, like every weekend has been this summer. But hopefully, whatever you did, it was okay, and you enjoyed yourself, and you are ready to go for another week of rain. Good morning. Welcome to the program. It seems to be a pattern.
Right? It does certainly seem.
We're in a trough of something, and so I don't know. It's hard to be like always in a really good mood because you look out and you're just. I feel like those kids in the Cat in the Hat. You can't go out and play. But here we are. We're inside. We're playing. We have a wonderful group. Let me introduce everybody, and we'll get started. We have a lot to talk about. Alan Chartak is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning. I did my walk. Took an hour and a half, and not a drop of rain
did
came.
Did it take
by.
Longer in the rain?
No, there was no rain.
Oh.
And coming back, I got back, and then the rain started. So I have somebody to thank.
Divine intervention.
That's what I was
thinking.
Say.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very nice. I just have to say, the windshield wipers, they're... You turn them on, and then you think, like...
And they go swish, swish, swish.
And they swish, swish, swish. And then you leave them on because you think it's going to continue to rain, and then it stops. And then you... I don't know how long it takes because they don't time it, but then you start hearing the... where it's hitting just the dry glass. And then you turn them off, and then it starts to rain again.
Sure.
Yeah. That's my contribution this morning.
Every time.
Yeah. my big weekend. Sarah Rogerson is with us. She is Albany Law School professor, but the director of the Immigration Law Clinic, and a great pleasure to have you with us this morning.
Always excited to be here.
Thank you very much for being here. Jim Ketterer is with us, Bard Center for Civic Engagement Senior Fellow and Dean of the School of Continuing Education at the American University, Cairo. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. It's very nice to be back.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. I love your presence here because, A, you are very thoughtful. You are very smart. You are very energetic.
Uh-oh.
And you also always wear a sport coat.
Yes, I'm ready for anything. I dress
I
for the crowd.
Just looks good. Dress to impress. That's right. For the radio, and I appreciate that.
I might have a face for radio, but I have a coat for ready for anything.
You know, you're all wonderful. You're here. You're great. And I thank you for taking time out of your day to be a part of our program. But kudos go to Libby Post, who's on vacation in vacation land, the state of Maine, and is still doing the program. How great is that? Libby Post is a political consultant. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
Good morning, everybody. I'm sitting in my second floor condo overlooking gray skies, but a lovely body of water, which I'm not sure what it is. It's not the ocean. That's
I was going to the Atlantic?
It's like it's an inlet of some sort off the Algonquin River, probably.
Yeah, well, the fact that you said to me, I'm going to be on vacation. And I said, oh, well, enjoy your vacation. You go, oh, no, I'll still be on the show. I'm like, really? Oh, that's lovely. Very nice.
Well, you know, this modern technology stuff, COVID proved we could do just about anything.
Did Lynn approve this?
Did Lynn approve it? Lynn, did you approve this? I'm sure.
Okay, good. All right. As long as Lynn doesn't.
I don't know
lie,
if my other
good.
Two friends that were with him approved it, but, you know. Oh, they're all saying yes.
Okay,
yes,
good.
So we're good.
All right, great. Excellent. And if they want to chime in on any of the issues, feel free to give them a microphone. Let's go.
Great. They're right here.
If you would like to chime in on any issues, all you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Okay, let's get started and talk about what is making news this time around. And it is it was a fairly busy news weekend, a lot going on, and a lot of the conversation, I don't know about you folks, I was hearing over the weekend was really about COVID and about where we stand as far as the concerns with the Delta variant and the unvaccinated. So these were concerns, they are concerns, they remain concerns. We are seeing an uptick in all places, all 50 states, but especially in, yes, well, southern states, red states, primarily, but we are seeing it here in New York. We're seeing it in other states as well. And the concern is twofold. One is the Delta variant, which is wreaking havoc not only here, but all around the world. The UK lifted all of their restrictions, even as their prime minister is now in quarantine and a lockdown, which I think it's fair to say he didn't do willingly. Moore was sort of shamed into it, but still. And
didn't he have it already?
He had COVID, yes, but he was what's the word? Was
exposed.
Thank you very much to it. So he was. So you don't give it to anybody else. They pulled him out, as it were, because that is what the rules, the UK rules are, and many people in the country thought that the prime minister should follow the rules.
As my Aunt Ruth would say, I see.
So there's that. And then there also in this country, we're seeing cases where people who have been vaccinated are also coming down and are getting COVID. So that is of great concern. And all of this comes to a much larger issue, I think, anyway, which is, what do we do for the fall? What do we do about kids going back to school? And how do we get the information of what we should be doing? And here's the key, will anybody listen to it? And how do you enforce it? All of those great questions I bring to the panel this morning in one big soup of COVID issues. And I think that as you look at internationally of where we are, and I think I have the numbers correct, 13% of the population of Japan has been vaccinated, 13%. And in 4 days, we will be starting the Olympics in Tokyo, Japan. And we are already seeing in this village where vaccination in the Olympic Village, where vaccination is voluntary, that somewhere between 75% and 80% of the athletes and those there have been vaccinated. The rest have not. And as a result, we're seeing a large number of people who have come down with the coronavirus. Alan.
How do you spell stupid? I mean, people who don't get this vaccination are not thinking. We know from all of the results, I think the number I saw, correct me, panel, if I'm wrong, was 96% of the people who are getting infected with COVID did not get the vaccination.
Correct.
96%. That's huge. Now, if you know you could possibly die from not taking the shot, how in the world, and I can't figure this out in my own limited capacity, how in the world do you manage not to do it? Is it political? So we know that in the Republican states, people are not getting the shots the way they are in some places like where I live in Massachusetts or in New York. So I just can't understand what's going on.
You know, Libby, if you look at New York State, the Empire State, our numbers of being fully vaccinated, meaning getting two shots, fully vaccinated, I believe is 53%, 53.8%. I realize this is somewhat unfair, but that's half. That means that you're doing around 50%. So that's still, I mean, that,
that's pretty bad.
That's pretty bad if you think about it.
Yes, it is pretty bad. And one would think that as New Yorkers, we'd have more of a grip and faith in public health and what people who are in public health are telling us. I mean, it could be, you know, that there are still folks waiting for their second shot and all of that sort of stuff, because that does factor into that 50, oh, just over 50%. But I'm waiting for the CDC to no longer consider these vaccines as emergencies, mm-hmm. but as real life. However, I just tried to look up however it is that they delineate, you know, like the measles vaccine or the chickenpox vaccine or rubella. And then it can be mandated. I mean, from my perspective, the IOC should have mandated
International Olympic
vaccination.
Committee. Yes.
Right. The Olympic Committee should have mandated vaccinations for every athlete. You know, they mandate all these other things, but not that.
Yeah, they tell you what you can't have in your system, but
right, but yeah. not about that. So, you know, I think that there are the folks who are vaccine hesitant, and you know, we need to have community leaders speaking out, which I think in Albany you see that in Albany County we have these ads running with diverse community leaders saying don't be hesitant, but people just need to get a grip that this is real. And people have died, and everyone needs to be vaccinated. I agree. It's like, how many ways can you spell stupid or ignorant? However you want to put it.
Stupid is easier to spell.
Yes.
The U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy said Sunday that he supported individual counties reinstating mask mandates to combat local surges of the coronavirus among unvaccinated people, like Los Angeles County did last week, as the pathogen's highly contagious Delta variant drives a spike in infections, and the Biden administration seeks to project a sense of cautious optimism about the country's return to normalcy. It's very reasonable for counties to take more mitigation measures like the mask rules you see coming out in L.A., and I anticipate that this will happen in other parts of the country as well. Murthy said that local orders are consistent with federal guidelines that permit local authorities to require prevention measures. Jim Ketterer.
So while we're talking about Americans deciding not to get the vaccine, you know, the virus knows no borders, and we really do need to think globally about this. Maybe in the immediate sense, we're thinking about local communities. But if we don't get a handle on this globally, it's really just going to continue to be a worse and worse problem. And so if you look across, I was just looking at the figures this morning across Africa, many of these countries have 1%, 2%, 3%, or 4% vaccine rates. This is not because of hesitancy. This is because of availability. They just are not there. They're not available. Pfizer and Moderna, we know, have to be chilled at a level that is just logistically very difficult to do. The J&J is not available in many places in Africa, certainly not in Egypt that I'm familiar with. And so, you know, people are choosing to just kind of wait it out. And, you know, you see here some really, really heartbreaking cases. So if you just imagine the way the Delta variant is ripping through a lot of societies that have that low level of vaccination, and now you add on to the fact that people are starting to travel again. It's not just to the Olympics, but, you know, you see planes are really filled up. This is a recipe for disaster. And so I think the United States and other countries need to not only tend to the issue at home, but at the same time be addressing how to manage the logistics to get vaccines at a higher rate out across the world, and particularly to those places that are most vulnerable, places where the public health infrastructure is not going to save you if you get desperately ill.
Sarah,
no, okay.
Yeah, I'm worried about kids. You know, right. I have two kids that are not vaccine eligible. They still live constantly in the fear of contracting the disease, despite our best efforts to reassure them that, and to take all necessary precautions. I also read in the Times, I think, a couple weeks back, that teenagers are having to fight their parents to gain access to the vaccine for parents who are saying they don't want their children vaccinated. Mm. And it creates a public education crisis now, in addition and on top of a public health crisis, which we've already been through a difficult year. And when folks aren't doing honoring community values and looking out for the most vulnerable, it has a ripple effect and creates an extended crisis that, again, is going to impact mental health and other issues for the kids. And there is the balance between privacy. You know, there's a reason why the Olympic Committee regulates what you put in your body, because there's free will and you have choice, and they have a decision to make about, you know, gatekeeping folks' individual choices. Mandating a vaccine is different because it overrides that choice, right? And so there is a tension there. But what we're missing in the conversation is the idea of how do we take care of each other? And that was present early on before we had a vaccine, in terms of flatten the curve, mitigating factors, things we can do, we look out for each other. That's all out the window. It's like, how do I get to Cancun? How do I get back to practice a normal life for me?
Yeah. And we have to take a break. I just want to real quick read this from Senator Rand Paul, who over the weekend was calling for legislation that would ban masks, especially on public transportation, and saying, quote, "The federal government forcing the American people to continue to wear a mask despite the fact that we've already reached herd immunity is ridiculous and needs to end immediately."
Oh, brother.
And saying that any federal requirement related to COVID-19 that an individual wear a face mask when utilizing any conveyance or transportation hub is against our civil rights.
Shame.
Okay.
I truly don't understand.
Calls himself a doctor.
All right, we'll take a break, and we'll is he a doctor?
I think so.
I thought it was a father. Okay. We'll take a break, and we will be back with our group right after these words and news from the BBC. During the break, gave me time to realize not only is Rand Paul an ophthalmologist, but he is certified to practice. His specialty, rather, is glaucoma and cataract surgeries.
You got to get really, really close to somebody's face when you're not.
You may even want to wear a mask, right?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Libby. I'm sorry.
The thing is that the real accrediting organization is the American Board of Medical Specialties and Ophthalmology, and he started his own national board or something like that.
Yes.
He started his own National Board of Ophthalmology. Because I'm not sure why, other than, you know, he didn't like what the standards the other doctors were, but he withdrew from the American Board of Ophthalmology.
And then he did let
it's a little strange.
And then he let his own board dissolve in 2000 as his political career started to take off. Is that the word?
So you gotta wonder.
All right, let's go to some letters here, and we will talk about other issues brought up by our letter writers. John says, if a vaccine is 90% effective, this means that 10 vaccinated people out of 100 will still catch COVID, especially with this Delta variant. Correct, right? I mean, it doesn't mean it will happen, but it could happen.
And as I understand it, less likely to be hospitalized.
Right.
Would you rather have 90% effective or 50% effective?
Right.
You know, see my point here?
Yeah. I mean, if you're not vaccinated. Well, and it's even higher if you're not vaccinated at all. I mean, it's, yeah. Okay. We go to Mary. Now is not the time to make nicey-nice with Republicans and talking heads who place party power, profit, and their precious, a lot of alliteration there, delusional propaganda over our survival. Biden's COVID and climate initiatives aren't strong enough, but even they are being blocked by the GOP, one that succumbed to industry propaganda and climate change in the 1990s, two has since had its remaining brains sucked out by delusional madmen, and three is getting vaccinated while pushing that madman's anti-vaccine bull. If Biden can end the pandemic and reverse the climate disaster by executive orders, he should do it as soon as possible. If we wait for the unlikely event that the GOP will regain some semblance of sanity, many, many more of us will die from COVID, as well as in climate-related fires, floods, storms, heat domes, et cetera, et cetera. Alan.
Well, I can't disagree with that. I would warn, of course, that the Republicans have the Senate 50-50. With one vote, and to some degree, you have to deal with them. You have no choice. While I certainly agree with the letter writer about the severity of this and what has to happen and what Biden has to do, let's remember that we live in a political reality which demands that the Democrats deal with and that Biden deals with these people, as disgusting as it may seem.
But I think that's not the entirety of the people who are not vaccinated. I mean, there is this political component, but we also have other people who have been against many different vaccines preceding COVID, preceding Trump, preceding all of that, just anti-vaccination. They're unlikely to change their minds on this.
By the way, do you know why? Because I don't.
But I don't know why either, but I know.
I think we disconnected somehow. I meant in the Congress, the Democrats had to deal with them. But the fact that we have so many people in this country who are willing to face death as opposed to do what's right and take a simple shot is beyond me. I cannot figure it out.
Well, I can tell you that this morning I was flipping around on the radio, old school radio,
turning the dial,
just to see what else was going on. And I heard another host saying, if you happen to get COVID, go home for a few days, take a couple of aspirin. You're not going to die. That's a direct quote. And I think that is, just outrageous. It's wrong. And then said, you might have an underlying condition and maybe you'll be in bigger trouble, in a very kind of casual way, as if that's their problem. I mean, the amount of purposeful disinformation is really astounding and reprehensible. But it's not all political. We do have other groups of people who are not getting vaccinated for reasons aside from the politics. And then the question is, how do you convince them to get vaccinated? It's not going to happen with just finger wagging.
Well, can you explain the politics of it? I mean, that's the thing that bothers me the most. I mean, the Reds are basically saying, no mask, no COVID vaccine. I don't get that.
Yeah, I don't get it either. And for people who are flying a flag that says "Don't tread on me," then they want to be angry at people who have made the decision to get a vaccine and to wear a mask. They want to tread on them. So there is a great deal of hypocrisy afoot.
You know, the president of the United States, Joe Biden, over the weekend came under some fire for blaming social media companies, saying that they are killing people by allowing misinformation to spread. But this would be the misinformation that you just spoke of, that you heard on the radio program and is being espoused by conservative outlets. And so I don't know exactly what you do about that, because the information is out there. And if you're vaccine hesitant and you have whatever news source that you trust is telling you that you shouldn't do this, just take aspirin and call me in the morning, then how do you fight that? And not to oversimplify this, but relatively half the people in this country are doing exactly that.
Yeah, I think we need a behavioral psychologist. We need Dan Kahneman or some of our best minds who are able to manipulate people into buying things. Not Dan Kahneman, but behavioral economics as a field. There needs to be some sort of behavioral public policy, that ways to incentivize and create norms that are shared among large swaths of people. And I think it the pandemic hit at just the right moment to spread, because we're not talking to each other. We're not learning from each other. We're demonizing each other. I was explaining during the break that I've been reading a lot of Hannah Arendt's philosophy. And she's experiencing a resurgence. And this is a Jewish woman, survivor of the Holocaust, who speaks a lot about, when we're not listening to each other, when we're not learning from each other, then it's really easy. She talks about the banality of evil. It's very easy for people to just sort of default into this. Well, I'm a good person generally. I just don't want to take this shot. And instead, we need to focus the conversation on what happens when people make individual choices that lead to mass atrocities. This is a mass atrocity. The number of deaths that we've experienced from COVID is stunning. And no matter how many visualizations, people have put flags on the lawn, right, in D.C., we've tried artists have tried to visualize this for people, and it's not sinking in because of how callous and divided and hateful we've become towards one another.
I'm struck by what you were talking about, Jim, earlier, of the problem that, that obviously this permeates around the world. And we're seeing this in places because they can't get the vaccine. The vaccine isn't there. The money isn't there to get the vaccine to the people. There aren't protocols in place. But this, our situation, it does seem to can't help their situation as far as globally getting the message out.
No, for sure, it makes it much more difficult if we're behaving one way and then trying to instruct people to behave a different way overseas. That's never a good recipe for effective diplomacy.
We'll go back to letters. Linda says, some people are vaccine phobic and television news could help by refraining from constant visuals of needles puncturing arms. My husband and I are fully vaccinated, but we cringe each time we see someone being jabbed. Well, maybe we just stop calling it jabbing, but that's another a small contribution, but it might help. Thank you, Linda. We go to Chris. I mean, I think it's probably generally said most of us don't like getting shots,
no.
But, you know, you get over it and it's okay. Chris is the first person I knew to get COVID in March of 2020, was 33, and she still has lingering breathing issues from it. The youngest person I know to get COVID is 24, 8 months in. Still has no sense of smell or taste. It doesn't have to kill you to really, really suck. Get vaccinated. That from Chris. We go to this from Kim. Forget the chances of dying if you don't get vaccinated. What are the chances that someone downstream will die if you don't get vaccinated? I'd like to work that out. Maybe someone with better math skills can puzzle it out for me. In other words, if you're the one passing it on, right?
Right.
I still don't understand why Republicans don't want to get the shot, period. I mean, I don't get that political division between those who are getting it who tend to be blue and those who are getting it.
So I listened to a cable news discussion on this very topic this morning, and here was the answer, and I want you to tell me whether what you make of this answer. I don't know if I buy it or not. But the answer is that one of the questions that came up is conservative hosts like Tucker Carlson, like Laura Ingraham, like OAN, like Newsmax, are saying that you don't need the vaccination. Mm. Why are they doing that? Well, they're doing it for ratings. Even if they themselves have been vaccinated, they're doing it for ratings. And the same would be true for the Republican lawmakers, that they're doing it for support in their region so they'll get reelected. Is that too simple an answer?
No, it's part of the answer. I must say, it's also, as I said earlier in the program, stupid.
Yes.
Because if you think about it, the evidence is before you. It says get the shot, stay alive. Don't get sick. Don't have lingering effects for the rest of your life. I can't, for the life of me, figure out the difference between the Republican and Democratic perspectives. This should never have become this, but it has been.
And it's become that way around the world, too. And several, I mean, it's not just us in that, right, Jim?
Oh, that's true. That's true. I mean, and Alan used the word evidence. So if your starting point is that you don't believe the evidence, or you don't believe in a world that's structured upon decisions based upon evidence, it's a very hard conversation to have to then convince people based on the science that it is a good thing to do, particularly if their politics are already auguring against it. And that's a much deeper problem. That's not just a COVID problem, as bad as that is. That's a problem about how we make decisions in general.
Kevin, in a note subject lined, is that a word? I don't remember. Plain and simple says, New York is half vaccinated because most of the people in this state hate Cuomo and have politicized this pandemic. The majority who don't get the vaccine can't give you a reasonable explanation of why without shoving some political ramifications into your ears. It's only a matter of time before we are all back to square one and in masks again.
I would just take some umbrage at everybody hates Cuomo. Everybody does not hate Cuomo,
right.
and Cuomo is likely to be the governor again. I don't particularly love the guy, but you know, I think overuse of some of that language is really not helpful.
Go ahead, Olivia.
Can I chime in here?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. You know, I think
this just in from Maine.
I know. A lot of people have said a lot of different things, and I want to go back to Trump as much as it pains me. You know, here was ostensibly to the majority of non-sophisticated people throughout the world, right? Here is they still see the president of the United States, regardless of who he is, as the leader, quote unquote, the leader of the free world. And here is the leader of the free world saying, to science, I don't know if you really need a shot. Masks aren't important. I'm going to destroy the CDC and politicize healthcare, you know, medicine. And so, you know, that might have impacted some of the hesitancy internationally. I know that it definitely has impacted the hesitancy here, as well as Republicans not getting on the bandwagon as they should, because some of them need Trump in November. Not this November, but next November. I mean, some of them might need him this November based on where they're running.
Right.
But they don't want to run afoul of that and his followers. And then you have, and let me be clear who I am talking about right now, the radical Christian right, not Sarah Rogerson, who's sitting there, who's a progressive person who I love to death, okay? But the radical Christian right, I have heard some of these people say,
so if I take that, you're not a radical.
It's God's will.
Not a radical Christian.
What?
Go ahead. We're confirming that I'm not a radical Christian.
Right.
Well, I'm radical in a different way.
Yes. I've heard some of these people say, well, reactionary Christian, right? I've heard some of these people say, well, if we get it, it's God's will. And my attitude is, if you got cancer, would you think that too? Or would you make sure that you went and got chemotherapy and all the therapies that you need and can try to survive? So, you know, they can have their own little apocalypse all by themselves and leave the rest of us alone. But the problem is that, you know, the variant and this virus knows no bounds. It doesn't know whether or not what your religion is. It doesn't know what your politics is. It just knows that you're a human being and you're a host. And that's it.
We have many more letters on this, and I want to get to them, so we will take a break. When we come back, we will go through the remainder of our letters on this particular subject. We welcome your letters on this. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Alan Shartok, Jim Ketterer, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson, all here. We welcome your comments. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. A lot of letters about what we've been talking about, including this one from Matt, who says, as a Tesla Model 3 owner since 2018, windshield wiper management has totally been taken over by the car. In a feature jokingly referred to as deep rain, my car's AI software knows when it's raining, when to turn off on the wipers, when to speed them up, and when to turn them off. I haven't touched a wiper control in years. Life is so good.
Fascinating.
Thank you, Matt. My car doesn't do that.
Another 20,000, please.
Dave writes, the COVID surge is being reported as a pandemic of the unvaccinated. It is having social and economic cost. How do we burden the unvaccinated with the cost of their actions? Interesting question from David. We'll go to Rich. The Republican push for personal choice versus public health as government overreach is such hypocrisy as they attempt to interfere with women's health. The personal choice propaganda is all about states' rights, controlling women, and anti-income equity and programming. When does personal choice override public health? Libby?
It's true. The same people who want, in Texas now, any civilian can turn somebody in and get $10,000. That person gets $10,000 for turning in a woman who's had an abortion or a doctor who's had an abortion after 6 weeks. So, and it's the same people who are saying, we want to control that, but, you know, you can die. It's okay.
Terry writes, my vibrant, compassionate, life-loving father died of COVID last August due to misinformation and lies. I continue to grieve and grieve with all those who whose losses and who have lost loved ones to the virus. When I hear people denying it or saying it isn't dangerous, they need to be held accountable for their desire for power over their desire for helping the American people. They need to be held accountable for the unnecessary loss of precious lives. Thank you for holding the truth. that from Terry.
So how do you hold them accountable? Do you put them in jail?
That's the question. No, well, I would never urge a carceral response to any public health issue, but
nice use of
I was
carceral,
say,
though.
I, was
I learned something today.
But, but the but I would say that a lot of it has to do with where people are getting their information, because you can yell and kick and scream and hold people accountable and say this isn't true all over the, you know, airwaves, social media, wherever, but people can bunkerize themselves and make them, they can immunize themselves from truth. And that's what's happening.
I mean, what? How you hold politicians accountable is you vote someone else into office. And if you can't do that, then that,
maybe,
again, is a deeper problem.
If you're in Tennessee or Kentucky or Alabama, you know.
We got what I would only call a rant, if you're ready for that. Do you want a rant?
Whew.
It's next to Iraq.
Yeah, no. Do you want...
Yeah.
Okay, you want
yeah,
the
rant? Yeah.
All right. Sean says, do you hear yourselves? You say people who don't get the shot need them. They're stupid if they don't. You also just said people who are vaccinated are getting Delta variant. We need health education. As someone who has grown up raised on WAMC and even driven hours to volunteer my time at fund drives, I am done with your station. You are steeped in far-left vitriol, and you should be ashamed. You speak for days about public health and that being the reason for mandatory vaccines. Well, some of us have exercised, literally, a way of life that promotes our personal health to peak so that we can fight off all health emergencies. This would be years before COVID, if not decades. If you're so concerned about public health, why don't you demand the CDC make a fast food, fast additive, steroid, opioid vaccine? Why don't we vaccinate everything? It's maddening to hear that those of us who were always concerned about promoting health and healthy options are thrown to exile because we reject a shot. I don't think you hear yourself sometimes, and I'm sure you're stewing, and this letter even gets read, with comebacks and deflections, with justification for taking away a right for a shot. You are truly sick.
Thanks for writing.
Yeah, bye-bye now.
Anyone else want to? Okay.
Well, this goes to the point of hearing people out, and I think we did, and maybe the listener wasn't listening closely enough to hear what I said about some folks having a stronger sense of rejection of the vaccine around their own private health choices. But when those choices impact, it doesn't impact others for you to lead necessarily a healthy lifestyle. It doesn't negatively impact others for you to choose to live a healthy lifestyle. It does negatively impact others for you to choose not to vaccinate yourself against a known lethal health threat.
We got this letter from Joe, who writes, Alan makes a great point about Republicans, and given the Tangerine Man got vaccinated, what is their hang-up? Then, on the other side of this, I disagree with Alan. Cuomo is awful. That's all I have to say on the topic.
Well, I'll be honest with you. There are days I wake up, scratch my head, and say, you know, I'm no big fan either.
Let's see. Fran says, I have a younger sister who won't have the shot, and her reasons are God and gospel. Will says, I'm vaccinated and desperately want everyone else to be too, but it isn't helpful that your panelists are calling unvaccinated people stupid. There are people who genuinely believe that the vaccine is harmful because that's the information they've received. There are
which
people,
makes them stupid.
There are people who are hesitant about getting the vaccine for a number of reasons they perceive as legitimate. Expressing some compassion and providing objective information will accomplish more than hurtling insults.
So let me just offer one response to that letter, but also some glimmer of hope. So I have a family member who works in public health in an urban area in upstate New York, not this urban area, and has been able to chip away at this misinformation and the lack of information, and is still able to convince people to be vaccinated, and says that at the core of it, you have to take the time to listen to people, to understand what their concerns are, and to address them bit by bit in a compassionate way. It's time consuming, it's labor intensive, but the payoff is really worth it. There are people who just are not going to be convinced for whatever reason, and that's going to be a different story. But there are still people who I think do, as the letter writer says, need more information, need to be heard out, need to not have, you know, the finger wagged at them. And there's still progress to be made in that regard.
There is a very good article in the New York Times this morning by David Leonhardt about the Kaiser Family Foundation conducting a poll at the start of the year asking American adults about the vaccination, whether they'd be getting it or not. 23% said no, but a significant portion of that group, about a quarter of it, has since decided to receive the shot. So what they've now done is to go and say, okay, what worked to get those people to get the shot? And that's where a lot of this work, and you were mentioning a clinical,
Dan Kahneman,
behavioral psychologist, yeah. Of figuring out what we can do to change that behavior, and there is work being done on that front. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other issues. We welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Jim Ketter, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson. Great group and lots of input from you. panel@wamc.org. So let's go to some more letters and then we will move on to other topics. To this from Israel. To echo Libby's comment, the resistance to vaccines may have been far less had Trump not trivialized for months the severity of the COVID situation. Unfortunately, this notion has caught on. Libby, are you with us? Okay. Quinn says it's not about, this is a response to the rant. Quinn has responded to the rant from the previous letter writer. It's not about you, you fool. No name calling, please. It's about protecting others. It's about my 9-month-old son. It's about my mother. It's about everyone else. That from Quinn. Nancy says, my daughter is 6 months pregnant. She is struggling to decide to vaccinate. The data is low when it comes to effects on the baby. And yes, I realize it's dire if both mother and baby get COVID. Misinformation is its own pandemic. I just want to drag her to a clinic to get the vaccine. Her docs say it's her choice. I wish the vaccine could just be mandated. I'm going to ask you, Sarah, this question. But
sure.
I have a friend who falls in this category who's not getting vaccinated until after their pregnancy.
Yeah.
And that makes perfect sense to me.
I totally get. I had to get the flu shot when I was pregnant with one of my sons, and they had to give me a lot of disclaimers, and that was unsettling. And
yeah.
I'm a lawyer. I know why they give a lot of disclaimers. It's not necessarily because because something bad will happen, but because something bad has happened and you need to know in a certain number of cases, right? But this is like the behavioral psychology stuff. How that information is presented to people matters in the outcomes of their health choices. So, you know, we need to get better at explaining the risks and benefits to folks. I empathize with anyone who is pregnant. Having to make those decisions are so tough, and there are so many social signals that tell you if anything bad happens, it is all your fault. And, you know, it's part of womanhood in this society as we live in it today. So I think if you have a real difficult time deciding, you just have to accept the consequences, which is I'm going to make this choice, which means I also need to protect myself, which means I probably can't go out, which
right.
means I probably can't see family.
Exactly. And the other thing too about it is that they're not wrong that there really is very little data on this. I mean, there's not much data across the board on a lot of the subject. I mean, not as much as you would like. But when it comes to pregnant women at various stages in the pregnancy, yeah,
it's a tough one.
It is a tough one. So for that, Jim says, don't forget that before they were anti-vaxxers, there were anti-maskers and anti-social distancers. They weren't willing to wear a mask to not only protect, save their own lives, but to save their family, friends, and neighbors. I think that once Trump made everything about fighting the virus as basically unmanly, that is what has stuck and will continue to stick. Somehow dying a pointless death is manly and the American way.
Yes. I think the fact that he also survived it and went on TV and made it look like he was fine, even though we know now that was very much not the case, was the absolute opposite message to send to the American public. You'll be fine.
Yeah, it'll all go away. All right. Libby, are you there? All right. We're still working on getting Libby back on. Ellen says, I recall Trump saying after the election that he thought it was unfair if Biden got credit for the vaccine since he was the one who invested in warp speed development of the vaccines for COVID. The whole thing about Trump is that he wants credit and appreciation and praise. Maybe we should take out ads thanking him for being so smart to see the answer was a vaccine. Every time he was asked about treating COVID, his answer was about the vaccine research. That always made me angry because people were dying all over the country and he was taking pie-in-the-sky vaccine development, but as disguising it as his behavior, as disgusting as his behavior was, he was right to get this done. Would giving him credit make him stop telling people not to take the vaccine?
No, and remember how this all got started. He stood up there and said that there was not going to be any COVID in the United States, that there might be one case, there might be five cases, but I'll never forget that speech. And now he wants credit for having stopped it? Are you kidding?
He also suggested we ingest bleach.
Yes.
At a press conference in the press room.
Right.
Right.
Correct. Okay. Let's move on to other subjects, and we will go to, let's see where we have time here. We'll go to infrastructure real quick. And that is Democrats and Republicans struggle to finish infrastructure proposal as key Senate deadline looms. Meetings between White House aides, top lawmakers continued into the weekend after senators dropped an idea to pay for infrastructure through better enforcement of tax laws. So now what?
Yeah, God help us. We don't want to do that. We don't want to get enough IRS agents so that the people who aren't paying their taxes, this is sarcasm alert, by the way, for the few who don't get it. We want to make sure that we continue to allow people to cheat on their taxes. And it's just absurd. The idea that we have a tax code, you're supposed to pay up. I pay up. Everybody in this room pays up. But obviously, somebody doesn't want that to happen.
They know that the people in their base don't, that a large group of people in their base do not pay their taxes. And that's part of freedom. We don't want to contribute to the collective good. We just want to benefit from it. And they know that from the rich all the way down to the mom and pop shops that just, you know, fly the freedom flags and the Trump signs and say, you know, you don't tread on me. And that's all the way from Main Street to Wall Street. You have people who either vote with their feet or their pocketbooks or their corporate accounts to fund Republican-backed candidates.
Jim?
I mean, I don't think anybody particularly loves the IRS, and this isn't, you know, bad politics for them as they're looking for the 2022 elections coming up to you know, bash the IRS as part of this and as a way to either get what they want out of the infrastructure bill or to oppose it, depending on, you know, which the member is. So, you know, bashing the IRS, there's going to be few defenders of it. Of course, as Alan said, everybody should pay their taxes and all of that. But in terms of just kind of sheer retail politics, it seems to be pretty straightforward. But the bill itself and how it's going to happen, through what process, you know, the arcane Senate rules, are they going to use the reconciliation process or not? All of these things are playing out in a big way this week. And I think a lot of it has to do with the elections next year.
Absolutely. And the question then becomes, are you willing as a sitting representative or senator to do the right thing as opposed to the political thing that will assure that you re-win your office? And that is, frankly, what is so disappointing because there is a lack of true patriotism in this country.
But I think what Biden is trying to do as, you know, a creature of the Senate himself is trying to make it so that they're not having to make that choice, that they are politicians. the Senate is a political body, that they're going to be able to do something that's right for them politically and still the right thing to do as well. I mean, nothing says jobs like infrastructure projects. And so this is the right thing for many of them to do politically. The question is, are they going to pay a political price by appearing to work in coordination with the Democrats?
Yes, yes, Jim. But what happens in West Virginia? Now, West Virginia, of course, needs these projects more than anybody does. And yet, it's political suicide to endorse this Democratic initiative. How do you answer that?
Yeah, I mean, that's why they want to use the reconciliation process. They want to fold it into that so they don't need 60 votes, so they can do it with a simple majority. But the ways in which they can do that are very complicated and require lots of other things to fall into place. And it's Schumer's trying to, this is a big test for Schumer as well in his leadership position. And Biden, who has, you know, said one of his key things is that he's going to be able to get people to work across the aisle, and, you know, kind of hearkening back to LBJ and Master of the Senate. But can he really pull it off?
Libby Post.
Well, the idea that the Republicans are saying yes to tax cheats, because that's basically what this is. They're like, no, we don't want the IRS to go after anybody because it's probably us who hasn't paid enough taxes, all the corporations, all their donors. It's really pretty disgusting, but the political calculus of all this is that for some, bashing the IRS is political payday. Because you've got some folks in their districts, you know, especially in the poorer districts, who don't want to have to pay taxes at all because they're having a hard time putting food on the table, and see and blame everybody else for that. They blame people of color for that. They blame, you know, anybody who is not them for that. And so for some of those Republicans, it's political pay dirt, while for the rest of us who actually think about these things, we understand that, you know, as somebody had on Facebook, getting access to healthcare is socialism, right? But having your insurance company deny your coverage, that's capitalism. And so the Republicans are supporting the capitalist model. The Democrats aren't supporting the socialist model. They're supporting the model that serves the most amount of people and to keep people healthy. But, you know, you've got these folks who are just anti-tax types, and they don't think they should have to pay taxes at all. And I'm like, okay, then when the flashing light at the intersection goes off, when the red light is no longer red, then don't come to me because you didn't want to pay your taxes because somebody, you know, slammed into your car.
Libby, let me ask you this. You're an esteemed and accomplished political analyst, and as well as, you as a professional.
Your former student.
Well, there is that. and as a professional, I want to ask you a question. Let's say in the unlikely event somebody hears you and decides, well, you know, I've really got to have her because she knows her stuff, and she's going to be my consultant. And they come to you and they say, now, Libby, my base wants me to, you know, stick to the Trumpian line. And yet we all know it's wrong. So what do you think I should do, Libby? Honesty question. What should she do?
What should the candidate do?
Yeah.
The candidate should find another consultant. How's that?
You're not taking that case.
I'm not taking that case. I don't work with anybody who's not pro-choice, pro-gay rights, and, you know, has a brain. So, you know, those kinds of folks, if
you've limited your clientele by a lot. You know that.
I know, but you know, I'm in New York, so yeah, it's really not that bad. I'm in the Capital Region. Well, not right now, but you know what? You know, it's those folks who like, yeah, I know it's bad, but I have to do it. Well, then find a political spine, okay? Find your backbone and decide that representing people and helping people is more important, perhaps, than maintaining your power. Because that's what all this is. All this is the Republicans jockeying to maintain their power. Now, I'm not saying that the Democrats don't do the same, and so don't anybody write in and saying I gave the Democrats a free pass. The difference is that the power that the Democrats want to maintain is for good things like choice, like gay rights, like fighting climate change, like public health. Those little things that will really make a difference in our lives, you know, right now and well into the future for our kids and for the grandkids. I mean, you know, to say that the flooding that we've just experienced in the Capital Region was a fluke and not, you know, because of climate change, you know, you're being an ostrich and putting your head in the sand.
Let us move on to another topic, and that is that over the weekend, I believe it was Friday, a judge ruled that DACA is unlawful and suspends applications. The judge said that President Barack Obama exceeded his authority when he created the program, but for now, people protected under it will retain the ability to stay and work in the United States of America. Sarah, we'll go to you on this.
I'm so tired of Texas federal district court judges trying to find new ways to get at this program. This is not new. This is not, I mean, it has to be a new angle. The good thing, the upside, let's talk about upsides. The upside is that this could galvanize Congress to actually finally implement a solution for.
You think the Republicans would?
Many would.
You
yeah.
think so?
Yeah, they have to. Part of their base relies on it. The people who benefited under who are benefiting under the DACA program, many of them have been in the country for 15, 20 years now. They're adults. They
never seen their home country.
Pay taxes. Yeah. they have gone to medical school. I don't want to privilege one group of DACA recipients over the other, but we have DACA recipients who are serving in our state governments. We have, this is an issue, and immigration is still, no matter what Ted Cruz tries to do or judges in Texas, is still a very sympathetic issue for the vast majority of the voting base on either side. So it won't happen until September at the earliest, and after we get through this infrastructure debate, but there's a real chance that once again we have an opportunity. We've come close a couple of times for Congress to put together a plan, and wouldn't it be great if it also served as a catalyst for more comprehensive immigration reform, which, by the way, is still badly needed. So I'm trying to look at the upside of things these days. I had enough of my Fridays ruined for about 4 years with announcements from the White House, Trump's White House, to be clear. And this is an opportunity for the country to fix this problem.
Are the people you speak to who are DACA recipients worried right now?
Yes. Always. They live under a constant cloud. Even under Obama, you know, when people were very hesitant to even submit an application because they knew when I submit this application, I'm giving over my information to the deportation authorities. They mm-hmm. know where I am. They can come get me and they can tell me to leave.
And in your experience as a lawyer, top lawyer in this area, does that happen? When they disclose who they are by entering into a legal foray?
So largely, no. The Trump administration targeted people willy-nilly, anybody who was on their radar, right, who they thought that they could go after. It wasn't because they had DACA status. But we have to have a conversation with clients every time when they're shifting from undocumented status into an application process because they are putting themselves on the radar of immigration authorities. And that in and of itself is a risk that we have to explain. For the DACA program, you know, lots of folks recognize that the benefits outweighed the risk, even in the Trump administration, because of some of the protections. But it's still a very serious conversation. It's still a deterrent to people applying. And now new applications can't be filed and new applications have been halted. I'm seeing reports of literally people having appointments to go and get their fingerprints taken and those appointments being postponed now.
So I don't get that part of it. The Department of Homeland Security may continue to accept new applications, but is temporarily prohibited from approving them.
Right.
So you don't, like, why would you, you know, I
to hold your place in line.
To
you know,
get in.
We keep telling people, get in line, do it the right way.
Right.
So this is the right way. This is how, this is one of the few right ways available to get in line.
So what does temporarily mean in this context?
In terms of, like, temporarily halted?
Yeah.
Until another judge rules otherwise, or the same judge rules otherwise, they're sort of, the applications are in this limbo land. If you could imagine it, they're sitting in an office somewhere. In a pile with, like, a pause button on them.
So judges are politicians, right?
I feel like that's a trick question.
It's not. judges are politicians. They are appointed because they have political influence. They get where they are. They're appointed by Republicans or by Democrats.
This judge was appointed by President George W. Bush.
Right.
Judge Andrew
Hammond. Okay. So sometimes these are predictable rulings.
Yeah, every single case challenging DACA, the vast majority have come out of Texas, Fifth Circuit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I don't know how politically predictable it all is, because in terms of overall immigration reform, Sarah, tell me if I'm wrong, isn't it the case that really both parties have failed in this for a very long time? We're mentioning President Obama before. He was known to some as deporter in chief.
Mm-hmm.
This is an issue that has bedeviled both parties, and they have created a mess on both sides. And I don't know that we can cast the blame just in one direction and to one party.
Well, I don't mean to, but will you stand for a question, as they say in the Senate? So here's the issue. Do you think that a judge comes along, puts his or her finger up in the air to see which way the wind is blowing, knows who put them where they are, thinks sometimes about the potential for advancing to a higher judicial position, doesn't want anybody mad at them, and then sort of straddles the line on a decision like this. As Sarah has said, okay, DACA doesn't work anymore. We're not allowing DACA. But on the other hand, nobody has to suffer as a result of this decision. Isn't there something sort of mealy-mouthed about that?
Yeah, I think so. The strategy is really the people who want to dismantle DACA, and then they decide where they want to file the cases. But that's true on any sort of advocacy front. It's forum shopping.
Right.
Right? You file. That's why
judge shopping. Yeah.
That's why you have this sort of thing happening, depending on what the issue is. The way that the DACA litigation came down, you might remember all the way back when it's gone up to the Supreme Court, it's come back down.
Mm.
They've left open, the Supreme Court opinion has left open sort of a roadmap for how you might challenge it again. And so potentially that's what's happening, is that they just want another, just like the Affordable Care Act, you know, it's the litigation arm of the Republican Party, and they're being strategic. But yeah, judges are political actors and part of this political system. So it's just another way that people try to challenge. Now, judges are some of the slowest political actors in that system. And so with the executive being much quicker, going back to the point that I think a listener wrote in about executive orders and Biden. The problem with immigration is that unless Congress passes it, you're going to constantly have this battle between executive orders and judicial opinions. And Congress has to definitively write into the Immigration and Nationality Act more protections, not just for Dreamers, but for all immigrant Americans.
Libby, we have 45 seconds if you would like to take that. If not.
No, I mean, I leave this one to Sarah.
Okay.
I would just say very, very quickly,
yes,
and they can't, the Congress cannot include this in the budget proceedings if they want to use the reconciliation process. What we were talking about before, if they want to be able to get through the infrastructure or budget things with only 50 votes, they can't throw in the immigration reform.
Which is music to my ears, honestly, because it deserves its own effort. It deserves its own conversation. It deserves its own podium. It deserves its own attention.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll have our last go-around with our terrific panel. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and two-hour panel discussion this morning. Last go-around with our terrific group, and we have about 15 minutes, so we'll make the most of it. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So let's see. I want to talk about there's two issues here, and I'm trying to figure out which would be most would be good to get out of the way here. My thought is because we have time for this, for a good conversation about Howard University. Two articles caught my eye this weekend. One is about, in the Washington Post, on heels of tenure debate, non-tenured faculty at Howard University decry the working conditions. Spurred by an anonymous open letter, instructors are reigniting calls for change at the university. An open letter addressed to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and incoming Howard University professor Nicole Hannah-Jones is bringing attention to deep-seated issues its author said are felt by devalued and disrespected faculty at the historically black institution in Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, the other article that I saw last night, this one in the New York Times, was titled "Historically Black Colleges Finally Get the Spotlight." There are star hirings, hundreds of millions in donations, but not every institution is sharing in the bounty, and some are struggling to survive. Not saying that Howard University is struggling to survive, but it certainly is having some very key issues. The New York Times writes, "Historically black colleges and universities are having a moment, one that many educators say is more than a century overdue. It may have started with the new vice president, Kamala Harris, who has celebrated her roots at Howard University, calling it a place that shaped her. Howard and Washington also recently announced a string of high-profile hirings, including the writers Ta-Nehisi Coates, Nicole Hannah-Jones, and the actor Felicia Rashad, who was appointed dean of the fine arts program. Money is pouring in. The philanthropist Mackenzie Scott has given more than $500 million to more than 20 historically black colleges in the past year. Google, TikTok, and Reed Hastings, the co-chief executive of Netflix, have given $180 million more. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill delivered more than $5 billion in pandemic rescue funding, which included erasing $1.6 billion in debt for 45 institutions. So with all of that happening, that is good news. And yet, when you look at the future, it still remains worrisome because of issues that are taking place at places like Howard. Alan is pointing at you, Jim Ketterer. So I'm gonna...
Jim Ketterer is a terrific administrator. Knows his college campuses, knows financing, and therefore, rather than come to little old me, I was pointing at him to say, "Don't go here, go there."
This is what we called in college vomiting in your lap.
Yeah, I know. It's always another shoe to drop.
Yeah, go ahead.
There's never a faculty member who's used the phrase "a terrific administrator" without having some purpose behind it. But that having been said, so, you know, before the pandemic, just in general over the last, I don't know, let's say a couple decades, we could see really massive problems building in higher education in the U.S. and beyond. My institution is an American accredited institution, but is overseas, but is affected very much by what's happening in higher ed in the U.S. And, you know, there's a little over 5,000 colleges and universities in the U.S. I might not have that quite right. And there are these, you know, kind of categories like historically black colleges and universities, women's colleges, like my daughter went to one of them, very fine institution, Catholic colleges and universities, et cetera. And they're not, as you were saying, Joe, they're not all being affected in quite the same way by the demographic shifts, financial questions, and also just the kind of tectonic shifts that are happening in higher education. And so we can see this playing out with this one category of institutions that you're mentioning, and how among this group of about 100, it's not at all equal. Places like Howard and Spelman and Morehouse, I think, are probably doing very well, but some of the others are not doing so well. And the money and enrollment issues are really serious, serious pressures. And then how that translates into, you know, the kinds of issues that were raised by this anonymous letter at Howard, that letter could have been written by somebody at probably every one of those 5,000 colleges and universities.
Absolutely.
Across the U.S.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is really, it's an issue that's been kind of put on hold immediately because of that rescue money that has come to the aid of many institutions across the U.S., but it's going to come back. That money won't keep coming over and over again. And, you know, this really is kind of an existential crisis for many of the small private institutions across the U.S., of which many of the historically black colleges and universities are. And also there's a separate kind of issue, but with similar outcomes, for the public institutions who have seen a massive scaling back of state assistance over the last 20 years, if not more, and raising of tuition. And I would also add, you know, it's been more difficult to attract international students who have been used to kind of balance the books in many
right.
cases. There's other reasons to have them. So this one category, yes, it's in the spotlight at the moment, but this is a broader and much deeper problem that is really kind of a ticking time bomb for higher education.
You know, I'm sorry. You know, I know a student, a brilliant young woman, who my family knows fairly well, of color, who has chosen to go to one of those elite, basically black colleges, over all kinds of offers from white institutions. So something is happening here that may be consistent with what we are seeing with Black Lives Matter and everything else that's going on in this country, to say we have to rethink the way in which we educate and the way we reward for what's going on.
Yes.
Sir?
Yeah, and this is on the heels of Cornel West's yes. letter to Harvard,
right.
leaving that institution. And it's another subset of conversations in higher ed around equity and historically marginalized groups and access to education, which hasn't hit all of the higher ed institutions equally, right? I mean, certainly women's colleges were created in part in response to women not having access to colleges like Princeton, which only admitted men until, like, I think it was like the 1970s.
In the 70s, yeah.
Isn't that right?
Yeah.
So, you know, that there's a special piece of the conversation that deserves elevating, which has to do with historically marginalized groups, access to higher education, people wanting to right the wrongs, sort of higher ed reparations, so to speak, how to get more people into the pipeline. But it trickles down all the way to the conversations that we're having around equity, diversity, and inclusion in the public education system, right? Because those are the feeder schools to higher education. Re-examination of the school-to-prison pipeline, and all of those deep conversations that are happening on the primary school level also feed into the larger crisis that Jim's talking about, because the more students you can get to pay tuition, the better off your institution is doing. And so all of these things can't be talked about without sort of linking them together.
You know, but it seems to me, and that's a really important point about this linking together, but one of the things that strikes me, even in this letter that was posted to Medium.com about the grievances at Howard University, so much of it is about, from the union, about non-tenure track faculty, lecturers, master instructors, and they want more money. They want the salaries raised. Can't blame them for that. and as well as policies that require them to reapply for their jobs at the end of the semester. Okay, got it. But one of the problems that I see inherent in a lot of this is that there is a lot of griping, and rightfully so. I'm not saying there isn't a reason for it. But it also doesn't have a lot to do with the students. It's more about the faculty. And my question is, how do you balance that so that in the broader discussion, it does come down to the students?
So if you've got a union anywhere, you can believe that the unions are, will be fighting for their members. That's what they do.
Right.
And so therefore, you know, take a look at state universities, private colleges, the unions will always be espousing that. And I think that's the point. They would make the argument, this is very good for the students, because if we get good people here and we pay them enough, it'll reflect on our students. It'll do well with our students will do well to have that kind of faculty.
I was really sort of surprised to read President Frederick's response to the union, that people shouldn't ratify the union. We don't need the union. He's the president of Howard University. I was really sort of surprised to see that. And, you know, if you pay your faculty better, your students will be better served.
Right.
I'm not saying that's, you know, 100%, but, you know, one would think if you're paying your faculty better, if you're valuing your faculty, that will, the folks who decide they want to teach, that will then be brought to the student experience.
So let's just point out that almost everybody in this room, I think everybody in this room is a professor on one level or another. So yeah. We are, you know, somewhat prejudiced about this. We do know that, as Libby just intimated, that adjunct faculty have been treated extremely badly in most colleges and universities, and you know, some of those things have been corrected, but a lot still need to be.
And I think that this issue has largely been insulated from the overall political process so far, that people see this as, you know, kind of somehow separate. It has nothing to do with federal funding or state right. funding. And maybe if it's, you know, your child or your relative or something who happens to be going to that institution, you don't feel otherwise affected. But when we get to the point when we start to see several institutions go out of business mm-hmm. and board it up, mm-hmm. many people losing their jobs, vacant campuses, this is really going to be a major political implosion. And people are then going to say, wow, what happened? How did this? And we have seen this coming for a long time.
There was that list in the New York Times, which had all right. of those very prestigious places.
And to your point,
from Scott Galloway at NYU, who was listing them, yeah.
And you put, and basically with the funding during COVID, put that on pause. And now we're starting to
briefly,
see it.
Briefly, yeah.
Briefly. We're out of time. My thanks to everybody. Libby, enjoy your vacation. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it. Alan, thank you.
It's great.
Good to have you here. And Sarah and Jim, be well. Thank you. You're in before you go back to Egypt, right? You're coming back?
Or I'm not sure.
Okay. All right. Well, I hope you are. We'll be back right after this.
Me too.